with a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Kirsten Hathcock is a multi-crime survivor, self-taught carpenter, entrepreneur, author, volunteer intuitive medium, and co-founder of the nonprofit organization, the National Institute of Law and Justice. Although she was born and raised in Ohio, her journey has taken her to many places and through many professional phases. It wasn't until turning 36, though, that her trajectory became much more spiritually based, and she realized she'd become reattuned to an ability she first experienced as a child. In the process, she would also recover memories of her own childhood sexual abuse. In uncovering her past, as well as many other victims' untold narratives, she has become an advocate for the voiceless within her work. Since starting her volunteer role as a medium in cold case murders and other related crimes, she has helped bring justice and/or solace to families across the country. The Broken Cycle Media team is so grateful for her energy, advocacy, and openness to share, and the listener's nuanced understanding of Kirsten's narrative.
My name is Kirsten Hathcock. I am an author. I'm a self-taught carpenter, which is kind of an odd thing to say because I didn't think that that was the way my life was going to go. I'm also an abuse survivor and a volunteer intuitive medium. I'm originally from Ohio and have lived all over the U.S. I had the best childhood. I have the best parents in the world. My dad was a football coach and a teacher, and my mom was a teacher. I grew up in a tiny town named Defiance. It was kind of a Friday Night Lights experience for me because we went to football games on Friday night. I was a cheerleader and I ran track. I really had the best of everything, I think, as a kid. My dad was always very supportive and always saying, you can do anything you set your mind to. There were no limitations. He was just extremely supportive, and so was my mom. I really credit both of them with instilling the confidence in me to be able to, later in life, try things like carpentry and do things that some people might not think they can do. I ended up going to high school in Defiance, Ohio, and then I went to college at Ohio University, which is down in Athens, Ohio. I have a communication degree from Ohio University. I was teaching, so I did a lot of training. And then from there, I really wanted to branch out. I ended up in North Carolina, and I met my husband in a bar. I offered him a fried mozzarella cheese stick, and that was it. It was love at first cheese stick. We ended up getting married in 1997. We had our first child in 1998, and then both of us ended up in the television industry. I was selling ad sales for cable networks. I worked for A&E and the History Channel. Scott was working for HBO. We moved from Charlotte, North Carolina to Atlanta, to Birmingham, and then up to Chicago for a while. We had our second child in Chicago. Both kids are just incredible human beings. We moved around a ton, and back in those days, in order to move up in a company, you pretty much had to move in order to get another job. There was some freedom in that, though, I think. We both really enjoyed the excitement of new places. Around the time that Grace was about 1 year old, that's our second child, Scott lost his job. At that point, we had moved to a small town outside of Cincinnati, Ohio, and we were looking at each other like, what are we going to do? It was evident because we had both now been entrenched in that industry. We had to either go back to Chicago, go to LA, or go to New York. So we ended up looking at each other and intuitively, not realizing that that was what was happening, said, it's LA. We can do this. So we pretty much sold everything we had and ended up moving to Los Angeles without jobs and with very little in our bank account to be able to support us, which was very scary. And he ended up getting a job, thankfully, within the first month or so. It was really great. At that point, I looked at him and I said, our kids have been in daycare, in and out. I want to spend more time with them. I really want to be home with them. And I know I can figure out how to do this from home. I did contract work. I nannied for a couple years. So I took care of other people's kids alongside of our own. And it was idyllic. We lived in Sherman Oaks. It was just really a fun time. It was around that time, though, I started really missing the creative side of my world. I've always been a DIYer from the beginning, right? So I taught myself graphic design. And in every position that I held in the corporate world, I was always doing that kind of stuff. So it was at that point, I thought I could do something from home that's a little bit more creative. At the very same time, we were needing a toy box. And we like that mid-century modern style. So I started looking on the market to see if there was a toy box out there that I liked. And they were so expensive. We were really living very much paycheck to paycheck. And that was the inspiration. I thought, you know what? I think I could build something. My grandmother had this old split top record player that I loved when I was a kid. And I remembered that. And I thought, I could build a toy box that looks similar, that has this cool retro mid-century kind of style that doesn't really look like a toy box, if I can do this and not lose my fingers. So I taught myself carpentry, bought a table saw, started building. People started saying, that is the coolest toy box. You should do that more often, or I would like one of those. It was at that point that I realized there's a market for this because there's really nothing out there. So I just started cranking out toy boxes in our garage. I would drive them over the hill. I called the company Mod Mom Furniture. I was driving our minivan to $4 million homes and dropping off toy boxes. I did that for about 4 years. I started Mod Mom in 2006. I didn't realize how meditative that time period was for me. Being in the garage, building furniture by myself while the kids are at school, that was actually what led to my intuitive awakening. Having that headspace, it's the same thing as when you're driving in a car and you have a really good idea, or you're taking a shower and the best idea comes through. I feel like when our bodies are doing something we do all the time and our body is busy, it allows that access from the subconscious to be able to come through, which is where I believe the intuition is. I grew up very scientific. I still am. I like empirical research. I did not grow up with a background in anything woo-woo. So it was interesting when I started to finally realize that, oh, I think this is what they call intuition. I was around 36. I'm in the garage. I'm building furniture. I'm doing things I do every single day. Very routine, but I would hear someone say, Mom, and I would automatically get up and go, oh, I need to run into the house. Wait, the kids are at school. Who was saying Mom? So I started hearing things. I started seeing things. I started seeing nails move across a workbench on their own. And I'm looking at it thinking, we're in LA. Are we having an earthquake? What's happening? Why is this going on? For a little while, I really did think I was crazy. I thought this has to be the polyurethane that I've been breathing now in the garage for 4 years. And I kept it really quiet because I wasn't going to tell anyone that this stuff was starting to happen. But it was basically like I got hit over the head and I started to notice that a lot of what I was hearing and seeing and feeling, it was all related to children. And I thought, well, that's also kind of interesting because A, I was a mom, and B, I had a children's furniture company. That was the beginning of me figuring out, oh, wait, something's happening to me. When I finally started to come to grips with it, I told my husband, I'm hearing and seeing things that I don't think other people are hearing and seeing. This is concerning. And thankfully, he said, I believe in you and I'll support you. keep sharing these things with me. The beautiful part too is cut to a couple of months later. I remember we were laying in bed. He's highly intuitive as well, not necessarily the same way I am, but we were lying in bed and he said, "Kirst, do you see that girl standing in the corner? She's got long, dark hair." And I almost cried because I did see her and I had actually communicated with her earlier in the day and I just hadn't said anything about it. The fact that he could see her too was so comforting. I was very lucky. But basically, after all of that, I thought, I'm going to go see a psychic medium. I don't know if I believe in any of this stuff. I never really had. I went to see her on my birthday. I was turning 36 on 9909. She looked at me and she said, "You're going to help millions of people." And I said, "I'm making high-end kids furniture in my garage. I don't think that that's helpful." And she goes, "No, you really are. And you have a gift like mine, but you're not going to, in her terms, hang a shingle. You're not going to be like a traditional psychic medium." And I remember thinking, this is nuts. But she also tapped into things that she couldn't have known. So the science side of my brain was saying, well, I can't refute that. But I did walk away from it thinking that was crazy. There were many, many times when I wanted to kind of block it. And I would just move on with my life. I was experiencing spiritual visits and working on Mod Mom for about a year before my dad said, "Hey, there's this show called Shark Tank." It was the second season of Shark Tank. He thought, "This might be something you want to do because you're growing the company so quickly." The lead times were insane. And I knew I needed to get manufacturing that wasn't just me. So that's what led me to Shark Tank. And that was in 2011. They didn't actually have the casting calls they have now. I just applied online. I talked to a producer. I had to put together a video and show me a mom in a garage with a tool belt kind of thing. I go through that process. I get on the show. And what was so interesting about it, here I am starting to recognize that I think I have this mediumship gift. I didn't tell them any of that, of course. At that point, I was also starting to get children who had either experienced some kind of sexual abuse in their lifetime or had been murdered by a predator. When I get messages from kids, and especially kids involved who have been murdered by pedophiles or predators, it was so triggering in the beginning. I was almost hyperventilating because not only do I see things and I hear things, but I was learning along the way how to actually manage those gifts. In the very beginning, I was actually feeling the way that they passed. If they passed from suffocation or something like that, I would feel that I was being suffocated. So through that process, I then had to learn to say, "Okay, sweetheart, thank you for sharing that with me. Can you make it so that I can see it outside of me so I don't feel it?" It was almost like working back and forth with them to establish how I should best receive information that was best for me too, mentally and emotionally. And again, I have no idea why this is happening, but I'm going to help.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So I am on Shark Tank. I am working with producers. They're helping me craft my pitch. Now, I wrote a pitch and they said, you should add this, cut this, add this, add this. By the time I got to the point where we're filming, we had a run through on a Friday and we were filming with the actual sharks on Sunday. I had to practice in front of all the legal team and in front of all the producers. So probably 50 people in the room. And I'd practiced and practiced and practiced, but it just didn't feel authentic to me. Well, I get up and I completely bombed. Now, I have a background in public speaking. This should not have been the way it went down. So I start to tear up and the producer came over and he said, Kirsten, it's okay. Just go home and practice some more. You're just nervous. We love you. It's all good. And I said, this doesn't even sound like me. And then everyone kind of swarmed around me and they said, Kirsten, you can't change. You're pitching in front of everyone. And I said, no, I can't use this. This is just not authentic to me. And they were trying desperately. I was getting texts between the time of Friday and Sunday from my line producer, from other producers. Don't do it, Kirsten. You're going to regret it. Don't change your pitch. Just keep practicing. I kept saying, no, I'm going to do what I know is best. So I was trusting my intuition, not even understanding that that's what was happening. I went home that night. Gracie had a little cheerleading thing. I sat in the bleachers and I pulled out an old receipt of my purse. And I started to write down, if someone would have told me 10 years ago that I would have an internationally known furniture company out of my garage, I would have told them they're crazy. And that started the pitch that I actually used 2 days later that got me 2 offers immediately, pretty much on the show. And I really fully believe that had I not stuck to my guns, I probably would have bombed again and wouldn't have gotten offers and probably wouldn't have even aired on the television show. So I get the 2 offers. I'm like, oh my gosh, I did it. I can't believe this. I remember thinking I should be so, so happy because I won a deal in Shark Tank. I'm growing my company and I've got an amazing husband and wonderful children and we live in California. But there was just something that made me feel, I don't know, numb. And I'm starting to channel more and more children, was being guided to reach out to very specific law enforcement officers because I'm starting to get more and more children coming in that were related to pedophile rings in some way. So I'm getting validation because as I'm sharing this information, they're like, how could you possibly know this? The first case that came to my forefront in working with law enforcement, that is, involved a little girl who kept coming to me when I was at one of my best friend's houses. This was during the awakening part, so I didn't really understand what was happening, but every time I would go spend the night, my feet would be tugged on at night. The room was very, very cold. I'm trying to figure out what is happening. Like, am I really losing my mind? And then sure enough, I got to the point where she told me her name was Carrie. She was basically saying that she was killed in that house. She kept showing me flashes of things. She kept showing me different things that she knew that I needed to know. She was abducted from a park while watching her brothers play baseball. She showed me the car, the color of the car. And so I'm explaining this to my friend. And of course, thank God Kelly didn't think I was completely nuts because she'd known me since I was in elementary school. My friend had bought the house. It's an old house. It had been flipped and made new again. She said, I believe you. I really do. She said, we don't know the history of this place. Well, it got to the point where I ended up even digging in their backyard for evidence. We found hypodermic needles. We found all kinds of stuff back there from decades past. At that point, we were able to discover that back in the 70s, even before that, it was owned by a man who was involved in a pedophile ring. This is horrific. I don't know where to turn. She happened to have had a good friend of hers whose husband was a detective. That was my first connection. I was very shy about talking about this with others outside of my immediate circle. I'm not somebody who wants to reach out to the cops, I'll be honest with you. But at that point, because it was as if the universe opened that door, I thought, okay, I need to do this. I ended up talking with him and he said, I appreciate it. I want to go down this road. Unfortunately, like most law enforcement officers who are working cases, the cold case division is completely separate. They're all overwhelmed, overworked. There really wasn't much we could do at that point. This is one of those cases that I don't give a ton of detail on. It's definitely still moving because, unfortunately, a lot of these pedophile ring groups are connected, not only throughout the US, but worldwide. And unfortunately, in many of these cases, justice takes a long time. And I thought, okay, well, at the very least, is there any way maybe I could share this information with her mom? That was the other interesting part. There was a door that opened. My friend Kelly was like, I feel like there's a relative of the mom who is attached to the daycare that Kelly's kids went to. So long story short, I end up being able to connect with her. I talked with her on the phone. I tried to make it as easy as possible for her to know that there was no motive for me other than I would want to know as a parent. The police department, of course, sometimes they put things out that aren't necessarily true because then they can weed out the ones who are basically wanting to take credit for some kind of murder. So what was put out in public was not what actually happened. And what Carrie was telling me and what I shared with her mother was what happened. She's basically saying, there's no way you could have known this. It was wonderful because we were able to connect and she just thanked me profusely and understood that her daughter was no longer in her body. Carrie was now not only giving me information about what happened to her, but then bringing other children in who had also been killed by predators. And so it was starting to become like a parade of other children. And this wasn't just in that area. They were across the nation. That was one of the things that I mentioned to her mom. And I just said, please know that she's doing such amazing work on the other side. She's literally helping bring other kids to me as well. And she said, I absolutely believe that. And loved the fact that she knew that her daughter was helping in those ways on the other side.
I'm sharing information with kids on the other side who are just wanting me to pass messages to their parents. And if they want to get their messages across, they will come to you. So I was just completely overwhelmed. I couldn't watch a news story without getting hit up by spirit. It was really hard for me to live a human life. So I basically thought to myself, okay, how do I need to handle this? And a friend of mine said, well, I think you can set some rules. I volunteer with a lot of highly intuitive children, and I always teach them this. So hopefully this will be helpful for anyone out there. But if you are highly intuitive and you're highly sensitive and you're like, oh my gosh, I keep being woken up at night. I'm on receptivity mode all the time. I have them make a list of rules. Like, I'm making the rules and I do not want to be woken up in the middle of the night. That's rule number one. Rule number two, only those that are for my highest good in spirit are allowed in. And that was a huge game changer for me. My channeling process is all over the board. In the beginning, I was literally looking up psychic mediumship for dummies. And that's where I was learning from other people, like, oh, what is a pendulum and what does that do? And why should I use that? A lot of times when I was struggling and trying to figure out this whole mediumship thing in the very beginning, I'm looking to other mediums and looking at what their practices are. A lot of times they're saying, I sit and I meditate for 1 hour. And I'm like, there is no way. I can't meditate like that. I do best when I'm moving. If it's more of a walking meditation, when I'm moving my body in some way, my process, if I need to sit down and actually look at a case, which I actually do today, funny enough, I work best if I do set an intended time period. Like I'll say, okay, around 3 o'clock, I'm going to do this. I will take a couple deep breaths. I try and get myself more into that mode. That's if I'm setting the intention and I'm setting the space to do the work. Sometimes I'll use a pendulum to kind of get things going, and I will ask yes and no questions. That has actually helped me locate remains on maps, things like that. I'll use tools as well. I think all of the rules are out the window in the intuitive world. If your practice works, your practice works.
The first time the universe kind of opened the door for me and made it very easy for me to talk with my friend's friend's husband, who is a detective. It wasn't quite as scary. The second time was scary. And I will tell you it was scary because I actually looked up this gentleman. He was Chicago PD. That was scary because I didn't have any open door for that connection. I just did it. The third connection then was Detective Mark Pucci, and he's retired NYPD, and this was in 2013.
I had come out publicly a year prior. I wrote a blog post and finally just said, hey, you know how I build furniture? And I was on Shark Tank. Okay, awesome. There's this other part of me that is going to sound kind of strange, but it turns out I'm highly intuitive. And so I talked about those gifts because I finally believed in them. And I started the Little Light Project, which was another nonprofit that's not around anymore, but was just open to sharing messages with any grieving parents who wrote to me and their children came in. Mark volunteered to work on a case as a retired NYPD and as an active private detective. And it was a missing persons case. I happened to know a woman that I used to work with back in like the early 2000s. She reached out and she said, is there any way that you would want to volunteer that you think you could help? My best friend's husband is missing. So that was the first case we started working on. I was, again, terrified, to be honest with you, because she then said to me, hey, there's this New York cop who is retired and he's volunteering as well. And then she added the caveat, he does believe in taking in all information, all tips, including intuitive ones. And so that made me feel a little bit better with her saying that. But for the most part, it was still pretty terrifying. We ended up talking on the phone. We had a great conversation. And he said, I feel pretty confident in my own gut feelings. Like, you can't be a cop and not operate off of intuition. He's very, very intelligent, very well spoken. He's got a heart of gold. He's just a really good human being. But he said, you're like a furniture CEO. What are you doing? A volunteer medium. Are you sure you want to do this? And I said, well, I feel like this is part of what I'm here to do. So I will do whatever I can to help. I basically got everything I could get from my home in Flagstaff. And he didn't give me any info, by the way, on this. There really wasn't much out there about it anyways. He did all of his boots on the ground work. And then we eventually met in New York because I was in town for furniture business. We met at a diner and we both had our notebooks. We both opened them up and basically they were the same. And by that, I mean, I was getting a lot of the same information about who likely, unfortunately, murdered this man. Mark and I both believe that this involves organized crime. We're comparing information. We're getting the same people, the same group of organized crime locations. I literally got a location of where the remains were. That was incredible, first of all, because even though it had been a little while since I'd been channeling, it was important to me that what I was contributing was actually going to be helpful. And so he kind of looked at me like, oh my God, I can't believe this. He had worked with other mediums before, but he's like, you're kind of an unusual one because you're not a professional. You're a furniture designer. We hit it off. We were like brother and sister kind of energy. So we worked on cases throughout. But what was interesting about that time period is that we weren't as close as we are now. Back then, we didn't know each other that well. And I was still very hesitant to share information with him because I kept thinking like, he's going to think I'm a quack. That's where our bond got much stronger, because one day I remember waking up really early and I had this overwhelming sense of dread for Mark. So I called him, which I didn't really do much. Like, we would text back and forth some, but I didn't call him. And I said, Mark, I don't know what you're doing today, but I'm getting this overwhelming sense that you are absolutely in mortal danger. And here are the messages. I was getting ethnicities. I was getting symbols. I was getting specifics on location. I said, there's a specific symbol. And there was also like horses. I said, I don't know where you're going, what you're doing, but all of these things are together. And I said, I don't know how this is going to help. And he said, Kirsten, you're not going to believe this, but I'm going out to the site where you believe and we believe that the remains are. So he goes out there. It's kind of an isolated area. And it's one of those areas where there's a park with water, not a ton of traffic. And I had gotten that somebody was watching him, like there's someone out there. So he gets to the area, he parks his car, he's kind of walking around looking, and out of nowhere comes this car. And this guy rolls down the window and is like, what are you doing here? In the thick accent that I picked up. At the same time, Mark said, as a trained NYPD detective, he could see that his shoulder was bending down as if he was about to grab a gun from the side of the car in the pocket of the door. And so all of those things came together in that moment. And Mark knew instinctively he's got to get a jump on him before this guy gets a jump on Mark. So Mark postured, he did his NYPD thing and showed that he also had a gun. And so the guy started to drive away. Mark gets back in his car and he starts driving down the road. So he pulled off to the side of the road. He calls me and he's telling me, he's like, "You're not going to believe this. What just happened? Basically, you saved my life." And he looks up and above him is a sign and it has horses on it. That was one of the signs I was getting, ironically, from Spirit. He just starts laughing. He goes, "You're not going to believe I'm sitting under a sign above me that has horses."
Mark talks about that case a lot. All of those things together helped him understand we were meant to work together and meant to work on a bigger scale. But that day was what solidified our friendship. We worked on multiple cases. We still work on many, many cases together.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
I was 36 when it all first started to happen. Around the age of 40, we had moved from California to Arizona, and I started having these flashbacks. I thought to myself, well, that's really weird. I'm seeing this child and it felt very familiar, but I wasn't getting any conclusion. I wasn't getting any directive on it. Until one day I was washing dishes and all of a sudden I saw a flash of my own face and it was clear that I was being sexually abused. That was what was so interesting. These kids were coming to me for me to help pass messages to help them. But I think in doing that, they were also telling me that I was in their club and that that's what had actually happened to me. It's probably what also contributed to my ability to be a medium because I can disassociate and compartmentalize, unfortunately, easily. So I'm having these flashbacks. I'm realizing it's my uncle that I hadn't seen in years, of course. And it got to the point where I then saw a full-on rape scene. And I looked to be around the ages of 5. I recognized the room I was in. You, as an adult, look back and you can put all the pieces together. Even going backwards physically, my mom said potty training was a nightmare for me. Well, of course it was because he started abusing me at 3. I had to have vaginal surgery when I was 19. I didn't know that it was from abuse. Even my gynecologist didn't. We just thought it was congenital, but it was scar tissue from the rape. I do think subconsciously, because of the abuse, I then learned to be a people pleaser because I'm always looking out, even subconsciously, for what's the danger. I need to please in order to stay safe. I had blocked all of this. I didn't even think that was possible. I had no information about repressed memories.
As part of a 1999 study conducted by the Dissociative Disorders and Trauma Program of McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, 90 female patients admitted to a unit specializing in the treatment of trauma-related disorders were interviewed. Data collected in this study illustrated that, quote, a substantial proportion of participants with all types of abuse reported partial or complete amnesia for abuse memories. For physical and sexual abuse, early age at onset was correlated with greater levels of amnesia. Participants who reported recovering memories of abuse generally recalled those experiences while at home, alone, or with family or friends. A 1994 study done by the University of New Hampshire Family Research Laboratory highlighted data drawn from interviews with 129 women with previously documented history of childhood sexual abuse, a large portion. 38% of women who were interviewed did not recall the abuse reported 17 years earlier. As the findings state, women who were younger at the time of the abuse and those who were molested by someone they knew were more likely to have no recall of the abuse. As illustrated by the same 1994 data, 1 in 10 women, which was 16% of the women interviewed who recalled their childhood sexual abuse, reported having forgotten about it at some point in the 17 years that had passed since the initial reports.
I wasn't seeing a therapist. This was all new territory for me. But I started getting confirmation not only from the children on the other side who were also kind of comforting me, like, okay, now you're getting it. Now you're understanding why we're coming to you. As far as the reception of all of this news that I had to share, starting from I'm having these memories of being abused to, oh my gosh, I'm talking to kids that are on the other side. All of that was very scary for me to share. But my husband was completely supportive throughout, even though I know it was crazy to have to deal and live with somebody who's becoming a medium. He didn't marry a medium. My parents, that was really tough, and they were very supportive. But my mom especially is from a generation where it's harder to talk about the dirty laundry, especially when you're talking about childhood sexual abuse and someone in your family. But overall, my family has been very supportive. My mom and dad, through the journey of me saying, hey, I just met this cop and now I'm helping on this case, they didn't believe in anything woo-woo at all either. Very salt of the earth folks from Ohio. Now they do. I did approach my uncle. I wrote him a letter after the abuse memories started to come back. I owned it and I said, listen, I don't know if I'll ever forgive you. What I'm here to say is that you didn't break me and that I'm going to use this to heal myself and also to help others. And that I knew that I was not the only one. I never heard from him. I didn't expect to, but I have a blog. I could see the details and I know where he lives. So I could see that he was reading the blog and following along. I thought in my own Kirsten way, I'm going to have to deal with this. So let me go to therapy. I'll talk about it. And I'm healed, not understanding that the subconscious healing that needs to happen is pretty big when those memories come out of the vault and not understanding how much our subconscious actually drives our behavior. So I'm thinking I'm doing all of the right things and had no idea what was about to happen next. But I just felt like this obviously was happening for a reason. So I'm working with cops, having this realization, I'm going to therapy. I hit a pinnacle of my Mod Mom furniture life, and I ended up being hired as a spokesperson for Stanley Furniture. They were going to take on my entire line. This was on such a huge level. They were predicting $5 million in sales for a year. So I thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I've done it. Now I have to go to a huge conference down in North Carolina. So I flew down to this conference in North Carolina, and I'm scheduled to do all of this stuff for Stanley as a spokesperson and launch the new line. There was a cardboard cutout of me and the whole thing. I get off the plane and my phone's blowing up. And there are text messages from everybody I know. And they said, did you just have a chance to read the press release from Stanley Furniture? And I said, no, I didn't. I just got off the plane. Well, Stanley announced that they had just shut down their children's furniture division. I'm panicking. I'm like almost hyperventilating. And at the same time, Scott had just been laid off from a company he had been working with. So I was now the main breadwinner. I basically realized that I just lost my job. And I lost my licensing deal. They offered to fly me back home. And I thought, no, I have to stay here. I have to try and get another job. So I stayed. And enter then this particular man named Tony in my book that was a friend of several of my friends in the industry. He was very kind. He was known as an international furniture designer. I was an underdog in that industry. So I kind of looked at everybody who was a quote unquote professional as like, wow, okay, these guys are really doing it. And Tony said, let's collaborate. I can't believe they let you go. He really kind of came at me with this professional pitch of, I can help you. He's trying to help get Mod Mom back off the ground again. It just felt like, oh, thank God somebody's trying to help me. And I believed that. And then it kind of switched into more of a narcissistic abuse tactics, like love bombing. he's clearly seeing that this is one of the worst times in my life. Everything was unraveling, and he took advantage of that. So I went down the rabbit hole with him. I really tested my marriage to the limit, and Scott and I separated. My marriage obviously had cracks in it. There was a lot of codependency that we didn't realize that we had had then for quite a bit of time. And I will say this, I take full accountability for my actions, and I will always regret that. But I also now understand I had just had the revelations of the abuses as a child. And this Tony man is pretty much a replica of my uncle. And I didn't recognize it. I'd never really met a sociopathic, narcissistic predator before in real life, aside from my uncle, which I was a kid at that point. I remember about 6 months into the relationship, I ended up going with him somewhere for another meeting. He made a comment to me, said, "You know that you look at men with a lot of eye contact." And I thought, well, that's weird. Maybe I do. I don't know. I didn't even know I was abused as a kid. What is hidden from me? And so I'm a person that tends to really look at everything and really analyze it. And so I sort of believed him, and I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't do that. So it started that curbing of how I would behave. He was starting to condition me, and I didn't understand that.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
During that time period, some of the same children that had come in prior in spirit that I was either helping on a case or they were children of people that I knew, they were coming in and out, and they were saying things like, "This is not what it seems." They were saying, "Get the restraining order now. Get out. If you stay in this, you die." By the end of it, I had gone through so much emotional, psychological abuse, and I thought, oh my God, they're right.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.